A historic hospital stay that could have implications beyond the White House. President Trump's COVID-19 diagnosis has left the public and the media struggling to know more.
The public deserves a high level of transparency and forthrightness about the president's health. We really should have clear and consistent communication about the basic aspects of how his care is going, how his medical condition is evolving, and unfortunately, we have not had that yet.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway from Monday, October 5th, what we know and what we don't know about the president's health and why it's so hard to find out more. Also, we'll discuss the history of presidents falling ill while in office and the secrecy that tends to surround it.
You can think of Grover Cleveland having cancer surgery on a friend's yacht in the middle of a river because he was afraid people would find out that he was afflicted with cancer.
Also today, we start a new series, A Votar, and we're talking to you, our Latino voters, about what you're seeing from the campaigns. And most of us are familiar with the Underground Railroad that led American slaves to the North, but there was also an Underground Railroad where slaves fled from Texas to Mexico.
As soon as runaways arrived, the Mexican people took them in, provided food and employment for them, protected them, and would not hand them back over to the slaveholders when they came demanding the return of their slave property.
But first,
I came here, wasn't feeling so well. I feel much better now. We're working hard to get me all the way back. I have to be back.
President Trump, one of Walter Reed Medical Center's COVID-19 patients, tried to reassure the American public that he's on the road to recovery in a video released over the weekend. But the president's sudden hospitalization and the unclear timeline of when he was infected with the virus, as well as other unanswered questions about the president's health, has led to a yawning truth gap between what the White House knows about his condition and what the media and the public know. On Sunday, the president's team of doctors provided a brief update on the course of his illness.
Regarding his clinical status, the patient continues to improve. He has remained without fever since Friday morning. His vital signs are stable. From a pulmonary standpoint, he remains on room air this morning and is not complaining of shortness of breath or other significant respiratory symptoms. He's ambulating himself, walking around the White House medical unit without limitation or disability.
While most Americans' healthcare issues are protected by federal privacy laws like HIPAA, questions remain about how much privacy should be afforded to the president who remains ill days after announcing he had the virus. What should the public know about the president's health, and when do we get to know it? To help answer that question and so much more, I'm joined by Professor Barbara Perry, the Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Barbara, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. Happy to be with you.
Also joining us is Dr. Dhruv Kuler, a physician and assistant professor of medicine and healthcare policy at Weill Cornell Medical College. Dr. Kuler, thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Dr. Kuler, let's start with you. The president's physician, Dr. Sean Conley, announced yesterday that the president was being given a drug called dexamethasone. Is that a standard treatment for COVID-19?
Thanks very much for asking. Yeah, it's a really important question. And so we know a few things about this drug, dexamethasone. The first is that it has been shown to be effective in helping patients with COVID-19, but importantly, it's effective for patients who have a severe case of the disease. So in patients whose oxygen levels have dropped to dangerously low levels where they're not able to get enough oxygen to their vital organs. And so the use of this medication suggests that the president does indeed have a severe case of COVID-19. It doesn't mean that he won't get better. A lot of patients that I have seen, that other doctors around the country have seen, receive this medication and recover in the coming days. But it does mean that the disease is not what we think of as a mild case. It's an important development in the president's condition.
We've also been hearing at least bits and pieces about the president's blood oxygen levels, which apparently are a critical piece of understanding how severe one's case of COVID-19 is. What do we know about that so far, doctor?
That's exactly right. So the blood oxygen levels are one of the most important markers we have of the severity of COVID-19 illness. We know that on at least two occasions, the president's oxygen levels have dipped low enough that he's needed supportive oxygen therapy. Generally, we think that oxygen levels need to remain in the 90s. We use 92%, 93% as kind of a marker. The use of supplemental oxygen suggests that his blood, the oxygen levels were actually lower than that. And that has happened on at least two occasions. Over the weekend, Dr. Connolly initially was evasive. There were some conflicting reports about whether or not the president needed oxygen, but it was later confirmed that he did indeed, at least on two occasions, starting Friday morning, require supplemental oxygen to keep his oxygen levels high enough in his blood.
Barbara, we've, on the takeaway, one of the pillars, the editorial pillars that grounds my version of the show is how this country struggles with a truth gap. How is the public reacting to what they're being told about the president's illness? Do they believe what they're hearing?
Well, the polls are showing probably not, and that's understandable given the fact that leading up to this episode and this affliction for the president, that the public was not trusting him on issues related to COVID. So about two-thirds of the American people were saying, according to the polls, that they didn't trust him on the information that he was giving to them on COVID. And even more specifically, they didn't trust him about a vaccine and its development. So it's just carried over into his own case of COVID.
What about the medical professionals, though, Barbara? Shouldn't the American public have a little bit more faith in what we're hearing from medical professionals? Or do I feel like there are some people who are saying, are they telling us the truth?
One would like to think that people generally do have faith in medical professionals, and I think polls over the years would show that. There have been polls taken for years about do people have faith in the media, in teachers, in the military, in religious figures. So I'm sure that the medical professionals would come at or near the top. But it's the fact that this person who's leading the team, the physician for the president, is probably being told by the president what he can and cannot say and how he should brief the public. I think that's where the skepticism is coming in. Also, given the fact that just generally, if you follow the Washington Post's tally of the president's lies and prevarications over his time in office, it's up to 25,000.
25,000 is a lot of lies at this point. Dr. Coulart, let's pick up on what Barbara and I were just talking about there, because I want to know, what is the American public supposed to know about a U.S. president's health?
You know, that's a great question. I think the public deserves a high level of transparency and forthrightness about the president's health. We really should have clear and consistent communication about the basic aspects of how his care is going, how his medical condition is evolving. And unfortunately, we have not had that yet. You know, in any doctor-patient relationship, there are concerns around privacy and confidentiality, of course. That's part of any doctor-patient relationship. But this situation is different. Mr. Trump is the president of the United States. The public needs to know some degree about how the president is doing. It's important for all sorts of reasons. And the communication we've had from the president's physician has not been clear and consistent. You know, on Sunday, he suggested that he wanted to paint a rosy picture, which is not necessarily a true picture of how the president is doing. And so there's a lot we don't yet know, and there's a lot more that we deserve to know.
Are doctors bound to confidentiality in this instance, Dr. Coulart? Is it, as Barbara suggested, could it be the president saying, I don't want this information released, and doctors are bound by that? Or does the president have a sort of special relationship? Because, as you said, he is the president, and so his health really affects the health of the country.
Of course. I mean, when you put a white coat on, your first responsibility is to the patient, and part of that is to protect their privacy and confidentiality. But this situation is very different. When someone is in a high level of power, when someone is the president of the United States, the public has a competing demand to understand how the president is doing, whether he is fit to continue to serve, what they can expect in the days going forward. And all those things are in tension. What I would say is that on the spectrum of where we are in terms of knowing exactly how the president is doing, we're far too far away from having clear, consistent, transparent, and forthright communication, and there's a lot more that needs to be done.
Barbara, we're in the final stages of a very, very bitter presidential race. What is the incentive for President Trump to be honest about his health right now?
I think in his mind, it is zero. He has zero incentive, and probably for most presidents, they would have zero incentive to be completely honest. This close to an election, we're down to fewer than 30 days until November the 3rd. And they want to be reelected. All presidents want to be reelected, and they're human. So they don't want to be releasing information that would cause people to have doubts about their ability to carry on with their duties now or for a second term.
And Barbara, last night, the president surprised his supporters outside of Walter Reed by having a drive-by visit. He was in an SUV. He waved to supporters. The windows were closed. Everyone inside the vehicle was wearing a mask. And yet the president is infected with the COVID-19 virus. The president has also repeatedly ridiculed wearing a mask. And so I'm wondering, what does all of this tell us? What is this moment that we're living in where we're seeing the president wearing a mask and yet infected with COVID-19 and yet going back to try and engage with supporters? Is he, what is the message that we're getting at this point? Because it seems very conflicting.
Mixed. I think we would call that a mixed message, but not surprising coming from this president, given that just this past week in the debate, as you say, he had mocked Joe Biden's wearing of a mask, saying even when he's within 200 feet of people, he's wearing a mask, and it's the biggest mask I've ever seen. But at least the president, on his way to the hospital and in this ride around the hospital, was wearing a mask. So at least he is moving forward in his thinking on this. But who can blame him for wanting to be out among the people, and the fact that people had gathered outside the hospital to support him? This is where he gets his energy. And some might even say it would be good for his health to be out and about. But I did notice that on some of the stations yesterday on TV, that the crawler said the president is joyriding around the hospital, which the term joyriding leads one to think of a teenage boy taking his parents' car and driving around town and doing things that are irresponsible.
Dr. Goulart, I'm sure medical professionals were also deeply concerned about what they saw as a person who has COVID-19, who really should be quarantining during this time while they remain infected, getting into a vehicle with multiple other people. Was that not a concern in terms of spreading the virus?
It was certainly a concern, and it was deeply irresponsible for several reasons. The first is that the president himself needs close monitoring, or he wouldn't be admitted to the hospital. We know that his oxygen levels have dropped from time to time, and for him to go out, it may be dangerous for himself. But secondly, he really placed at risk the health of those that were around him, inside the car, anyone that he interacted with along the way. We know that he was wearing a mask, but masks are by no means 100% protective, either for the people wearing them or anyone else. And so wearing a mask was a step in the right direction, but overall, this was a very irresponsible set of behaviors that he demonstrated over the course of the last day. And I think public health officials and medical professionals feel very strongly about that.
Dr. Goulart, even if the president's doctors are unable to or unwilling to divulge every aspect of his medical care to give him some modicum of privacy, do those doctors have a duty to be completely honest about the things they do disclose to the public?
They do have a duty to be honest, and there's several things that would be important for us to know. We want to know basics about the president's oxygen levels, but we also want to know information about potentially his x-rays and CT scans. We want to know whether there's damage to the lungs or other organs. Importantly, we want to know when he last tested negative. When did his illness start? When did he know that he was exposed to the virus? And when did he know that he actually had the virus? Did he continue to meet with other people during that period of time? It seems that that is potentially likely now. And that carries all sorts of both clinical implications, but also ethical implications. And so, you know, we really need a lot more transparency, a lot more understanding about the basics about how the president is doing. We don't need to know every single lab value. We don't need to know every single detail about what has happened over the course of the day, but we need a clear and forthright communication about the basics, and we just haven't had that yet.
Professor Barbara Perry is the Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, and Dr. Dhruv Goulart is a physician and assistant professor of medicine and healthcare policy at Weill Cornell Medical College. Thanks to you both.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
President Trump is not the first sitting president whose health has been compromised while in office. There's a long history of health concerns in the White House, both physical and mental, from President Abraham Lincoln's suspected depression to President Franklin D. Roosevelt's struggles with polio. Back with us to discuss is Professor Barbara Perry, the Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Barbara, thanks for sticking around with us.
Oh, it's always good to be with you.
So what are some of the more notable medical problems, psychological or physical, that past presidents have had while in office?
You mentioned Abraham Lincoln. It's known now that he had suffered from depression. He also had Marfan's disease. And at this time in the 1860s, while he was president, of course, there would have been no treatment for depression, no cognitive behavioral therapy through counseling, or certainly no pharmaceuticals that he could have been given. And I would say even to this day, it would be very difficult for a president or a presidential candidate to admit to having a mental illness. I think even just our society is not particularly open to that. And we saw what happened in the 1970s with Thomas Eagleton, who had been named to the vice presidential slot by George McGovern in 1972. And he admitted to having had mental illness and having shock treatments, and he had to get off the ticket. Physical issues, of course, are paramount in presidential history, and that those we have known about sometimes after the fact. But you can think of Grover Cleveland having cancer surgery on a friend's yacht in the middle of a river because he was afraid people would find out that he was afflicted with cancer. And you mentioned FDR and polio. People did know that he had been afflicted with polio in the early 1920s, and he went on to be elected the governor of New York and then, of course, four times as president. That wasn't so much the issue, but the fact that at the end, for his run for the fourth time in 1944, he had a diagnosis of congestive heart failure, but that his physicians didn't even want to tell him that it was so serious.
Woodrow Wilson got the flu during the 1918 flu pandemic. How was that handled? And are there any parallels? Because so many people have been talking about the 1918 flu pandemic, but do you see any historical parallels there?
I do. And it was fortunate for him, unfortunate that he came victim to the flu of the pandemic of 1918-19, but fortunate for him that he was out of the country. The bad news on that score, though, was that he was at the Versailles Treaty negotiations when he came down with it. And apparently it was a very bad case. He had to take to his bed. He was terribly feverish and even went into some delirium, but then came back and was able to go back into the negotiations. But again, it was helpful for him to be out of the country and, of course, with media and issues related to trying to navigate messaging and that sort of thing at the time, not nearly as much as we have today. So they could kind of keep that secret. But then when he came back to the States, he underwent this very debilitating tour around the country and a whistle stop to try to get people to support the Versailles Treaty and get the word to the Senate that they should approve it. It failed. And then he got back to the White House and had a terribly debilitating stroke that was also kept secret from the American people. And folks to this day say that Mrs. Wilson, the First Lady, was basically running the White House.
You mentioned the media, Barbara, and I'm wondering, I mean, right now, at least with President Trump, we're seeing a lot of reporters who are also saying they're concerned about not having the full story, at least enough transparency from the president. But has the media been complicit in helping cover up presidential illnesses in the past?
Yes, they have been. And we can go back to FDR, that he had asked, for example, that he not be pictured in his wheelchair, and that he asked that the media be very careful in how he was portrayed. He did not want to ever be portrayed being carried, because he would have to be carried from a car to a podium, as an example. Or they would wait until he was up and buckled into his leg braces, and then he could stand and hold on to someone's arm and then have a cane in the other hand. And it would look as though he was standing under his own power, or even moving just a little bit under his own power. But the media had to be complicit, and they wanted to follow, I think, that These were his wishes, and he wished not to be viewed as being a paraplegic to the American people and to the world. I think as well with President Kennedy, there had been word that had gotten out from his rival Lyndon Johnson at the 1960 convention that he had Addison's disease, and he did have Addison's disease. And his camp, including physicians, sort of poo-pooed the idea, pushed it aside, and said, doesn't he look healthy? And Kennedy always fought to look healthy. And so just as the media covered up his womanizing, I think in many ways they also were complicit to cover up his many medical conditions.
Barbara, have there been instances where presidents' medical conditions affected policy and or their ability to do the job?
Well, I would say yes. For Eisenhower, for example, although I need to give Ike the gold star for his five stars in his generalship, but the fact that he was the most transparent, I think you can say, of any of our presidents about very serious health conditions that he had. And think of it this way. He had his severe heart attack in 1955 while visiting his in-laws in Denver. And obviously at that time, they did not have the kinds of treatment for heart disease as they have now. They didn't have heart bypass surgery available to doctors. They didn't have the kinds of pharmaceuticals they had now. He was in an oxygen tent for a while, but he was confined to the hospital for 7 weeks in Denver. He was so seriously ill that they couldn't get him back to Washington. And so just the very fact that he was so ill had to have an impact on policies at the time, just that he couldn't be the forthright and strong president that we would have expected. And thank goodness actually for Richard Nixon, because he was a good vice president and he was very much engaged in the process at the time. But Ike said to his presidents and his press secretary, tell the people everything.
Professor Barbara Perry is the director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Barbara, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tenzia.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
In 2020, a record number of Latinos are eligible to vote in the U.S. election. And for the first time in U.S. history, the number of eligible Latino voters actually exceeds the number of eligible Black voters. And that has translated into a fair amount of lip service paid to the Latino community this election cycle from both President Trump and Joe Biden. But many politicians and mainstream media outlets still have a weak grasp on both the diversity within the U.S. Latino population and the issues that matter most to Latino voters. Here's former presidential candidate Julian Castro speaking with me on The Takeaway back in July about the media's coverage of Latinos.
If it has to do with immigration, you know, they're all right there. You know, you're getting a lot of coverage. Hey, you know, let's figure out what Latinos have to say about this. But if it deals with something else, whether it's police violence or jobs in the economy or healthcare or technology or you name it, well, that's not really, That's not a Latino issue.
All this month on The Takeaway, we'll be exploring some of the issues that matter most to Latino voters in a series we're calling A Votar. You can call us with your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Llámenos al 877-869-8253. I'm joined now by Mark Hugo Lopez, the Director of Global Migration and Demography at the Pew Research Center. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I have a couple quick questions for you now, and we'll continue after the break. What are some of the top issues that have emerged, Mark, in the Pew survey that Latino voters have for the 2020 election?
Well, with COVID-19 and the economic impact that that's had on the nation, particularly Latinos, it's perhaps what you might expect, that the economy is a top issue for Latinos, that health care and the coronavirus outbreak response are the top three issues that Latino voters tell us are important for determining their vote this year. I'd also add that the fourth most important issue they cited was racial and ethnic inequality. These are issues that many Americans also point to, but notably, this is a somewhat different rating than we saw in December before the coronavirus outbreak, when the economy and immigration were tied as top issues for Latinos then.
How has that translated to the data, Mark? Because are Latinos experiencing sort of an awakening of their own racial identity in this country, and how it's affected by many of the issues that we've talked about just now? Where does that come from?
So we are seeing an awareness of both identity. So people saying I'm Afro-Latino or I'm Afro-Caribbean. In our surveys, about 25% of Latino adults identify as Afro-Latino if you directly ask them. But there's also been a growing awareness in the population of there is also some racial discrimination and racial issues to address within the Hispanic population. And that's also shaping some of the conversation. But I'd say that even before everything that's happened over the course of the last year, we were already hearing from Latinos that they were concerned about their place in the country. They were experiencing discrimination. And some of that was based on things like, hey, you should go home. Don't speak Spanish here. You speak English here, or go back to your home country. So there have been some incidents over the last few years during the Trump years that have impacted Latinos and have shaped how they see their place in the country.
Mark, we just broke down the racial demographics here about how Latinos are identifying and how important racial issues are to this population heading into 2020. What about gender? What about, are there differences in responses between Latino men and Latina women in the polling?
Yes, there is. In fact, we've been seeing a growing gap in views between Hispanic men and Hispanic women over the course of the last few years. So, both Hispanic men and Hispanic women, for example, both support Joe Biden in the upcoming election, and a majority of both groups do. But you do see this gap emerging where there are more men, or men tend to lean more towards the Republican Party than you see among women. And this is a pattern that you also see when it comes to support for things like, for example, minimum wage or health care, where women are more likely to support those policies than their male counterparts among the Latino population in the United States. But that reflects something that's more broadly happening in the United States overall, where there is an emerging gender gap on a number of issues. And Latinos in this case are much like everybody else.
Mark, does that sort of help us understand a little bit more about the conservative Latinos? There have been a couple of narratives that have been emerging that, quite frankly, I think have missed a lot of the conversation, because we know about a quarter of Latinos voted for President Trump, at least Latino men, in 2016. So is this reflecting anything different about how conservative Latinos are feeling about President Trump?
This is something that we've been tracking, as you've noted, for several years now. And this is something that's emerged during the Trump years, but also more broadly, there has been a level of support for Republican candidates over the course of the years that extends all the way back to the 1980s. So anywhere from a quarter to about 30% of Latino voters, with one exception being 2004, with 40+%. But in those years, they have supported Republican presidential candidates like George Bush or Ronald Reagan. So there has been a conservative thread within the Latino electorate for a number of years. And this year is perhaps much like those other ones. But as you noted, there's been a lot of attention paid to some of the diversity and differences within the population. So, for example, a lot of focus on Florida with its Cuban vote, which is a more conservative or at least Republican-leaning vote. And also a lot of discussion about the emerging Venezuelan vote in Florida, while still not as large as the Cuban vote, is one that is looking to be just as Republican, if not more so, than their Cuban counterparts in Florida.
Mark, what about the issues that arise when it comes to things like climate change? Is that considered important for Latinos as well?
Yes, and this is actually one of the places where Latinos stand out compared to the U.S. public overall. So in our survey, we found that, for example, 60% of Latino registered voters said that climate change was a very important issue to their vote in the 2020 presidential election. By comparison, 42% of the U.S. public says the same. And this is a pattern that we've seen in other surveys we've done on climate change. Latinos are concerned about climate change, and they're concerned partly because of the future that will mean for their children. And worried about the next generation has been one of the key things we see that distinguishes Latinos compared to other groups of Americans. They're oftentimes very concerned about how their children will be doing financially, what opportunities they will have, and this is one example of that.
Have we noticed any differences between native-born and non-native-born Latinos, Mark?
In issues like immigration, that might rate higher for foreign-born or naturalized U.S. citizen Latino registered voters. But for the most part, the differences are about the same. And that reflects, I think, the shared impact of the coronavirus outbreak, both in terms of health issues, but also in terms of economics, because both U.S.-born and foreign-born Latinos saw their unemployment rates skyrocket earlier this year.
We'll be paying a lot of attention to this as our series continues. Mark Hugo Lopez is the Director of Global Migration and Demography at the Pew Research Center. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Also, if you're listening and you're one of our Latino listeners, we want to keep hearing from you. What story should we be focusing on as we continue our series on Latino voters in 2020? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Llámenos al 877-869-8253. You can find all the segments from this series online at thetakeaway.org/Latino voters. Many Americans have heard of the Underground Railroad, the network of secret routes in the U.S. that helped black slaves escape from the South to free states up north. But there's another Underground Railroad network that is not as well known.
The Underground Railroad to Mexico was this clandestine path that led enslaved people to freedom by going through trails of the thick forest and the desert, from Louisiana through Texas and eventually Mexico, through the Rio Grande.
That's Russell Contreras, an Associated Press reporter on the Race and Ethnicity Desk. And he recently reported on a different network that helped enslaved people escape from southern states further south to Mexico.
Growing up in Houston, Texas, in public schools, I've always heard about the Underground Railroad to Mexico. But it wasn't until I went to Houston after Hurricane Harvey, as I was touring an area called Freemanstown, a place built by emancipated enslaved people, that I heard someone say, an activist, this is a home that was destroyed around the corner, and that was linked to the Underground Railroad to Mexico. And when I brought it up with my editors at the time that, hey, this is really interesting, they were blown away. A lot of my black colleagues had never heard of it. And I was blown away that they hadn't heard of it. I thought this was something that everybody knew about.
It's a little known piece of American history, but it has big historical and present day significance as the national uprising for racial justice continues across the country. Roseanne Bachagarza is a professor and the program manager of the Community Historical Archaeology Project with Schools, or CHAPS, program at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. Roseanne, great to have you with us.
Greetings from Deep South Texas.
Also on the line with us is Ron Wilkins, retired adjunct professor of Africana Studies at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Roseanne, we'll start with you. Tell us about the families that arrived at the border. Who were they and what was their background?
Well, there's two particular families that I'm researching with regard to this subject, the Webbers and the Jacksons. Both of them have white husbands, John Ferdinand Weber and Nathaniel Jackson, and they are both married to emancipated slaves. The Webbers were settlers in the Austin colony in the 1820s, and John Weber arrived there as a single man and met the neighbor's slave, Sylvia Hector, had a relationship with her that produced a child. And by the time he was able to procure her freedom, they had three children together. And his intention the entire time was to build a life with Sylvia and to be a family. The Jacksons out of Alabama, it's the same type of situation. Nathaniel Jackson was a white man, a white plantation owner, who his love was Matilda Hicks. She was a slave originally on his father's plantation in Georgia. She had three children from a previous relationship and then seven children with him.
Thank you for that history. Ron, can you inform our listeners a little bit about why people were leaving for Mexico as opposed to northern states?
Well, Mexico was closer. And what Mexico offered, as soon as runaways arrived, the Mexican people took them in, provided food and employment for them, protected them, and would not hand them back over to the slaveholders when they came demanding the return of their slave property. So Mexico was very close. And it's interesting that this history has been suppressed, totally, completely hidden. It's not talked about in the schools, but it's so important because that history, one of the most fascinating things about this research for me has been the Tejanos, the Mexicanos there in Tejas, in Texas, who helped not only the runaways escape, but also mount rebellions against slaveholders. And that they were punished for that throughout Texas by the whites.
And Ron, why do you think this piece of history, you mentioned it's something that's little known. I mean, it was the first time I heard about it was reading Russell's story in the Associated Press. Why do we not know as much about this piece of history?
Well, the white supremacists in this country want to keep black and brown people divided. It's interesting because in the year 2007, the U.S. Census Bureau reported that there are 3,141 counties that make up the United States. 303 of those counties have a majority people of color. And though that majority is mostly black and brown and mostly Mexicano and black. And what's feared is that more that's almost one in 10 of US counties. I live in LA County, which is a majority black brown county. The fear is that if we our numbers continue to grow like that in the counties and we begin to learn this history, we will demand more of what is available. We'll demand our fair share of jobs, of positions in higher education, and so on. And that means that the white group has to get by with less. That's a great fear that the white supremacists have and a great many white people in this country have.
Roseanne, we have about a minute left in this part of the conversation. How did the network actually work? Was it similar to what we understand happened from those similar networks that were leading up north?
Well, this was not quite the same as we learn in our classrooms about the Underground Railroad going north. These trails were pathways through Texas into freedom in Mexico. So the pathway that people chose to come down to the river's edge in Hidalgo County and seek respite with the Weber family and the Jackson family before heading on across the river into Mexico, these were pathways that had been traveled by various groups throughout time. And so with the feelings of discrimination, with feelings of being taken advantage of and not being able to enjoy their freedom, that pushed these people toward freedom in Mexico.
What happened to the communities? Did this create a community of people on the border who were of mixed race heritage?
Well, they just simply were moving their families most likely to Mexico, but had stopped there right on the border, bought property and established their ranches a few years apart and a few miles apart. So these were like-minded people who found a place to settle and live in peace and harmony with their families, and then immediately assimilated into the Tejano culture along the U.S.-Mexico border at that time. So when these folks were traveling through to freedom in Mexico, they would stop there for a rest or some respite. The families were kind and welcoming and helped them across the river into free Mexico on their licensed ferry landing boats. And in some cases, some of the families that came through these ranches decided to stay on this side of the border and live amongst these families and not go into Mexico, you know, knowing full well they were very close to the river and would be able to escape across it if there were any slave catchers coming through or any danger.
Ron, I want to bring in a historical element here, some context, because in 1857, something happened in the United States, both in the U.S. and Mexico, that was a pretty important backdrop here. Tell us what that was.
Yes, 1857, you had Dred Scott and his wife had been enslaved, and they were in Missouri, and they were taken by the owner further north to Illinois and some other areas which were considered free states, and they got legal help and sued for their freedom. The case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that's where the decision was handed down that black people had no rights that whites were bound to respect. That same year, that was 1857, of course, the same year in Mexico, the Mexican Congress adopted Article 13, which declared that any enslaved person setting foot on Mexican soil was from that moment on free. So here's the contrast between two different nations. You're free if you arrive in Mexico and you had been a slave, and in the United States, you had no rights that whites were bound to respect.
And Roseanne, when we look at studying this part of American history, why is it important to note the alliance between Mexicans and African Americans during that time?
Well, they were, in a way, like-minded at the time, and they got along very well. So you had this pathway through Texas that some say today is, they call it a freedom road, that passed through the center of Texas, basically on down to Monclova, Mexico. And as these runaway slaves are passing through Texas and seeking their freedom in Mexico, they're coming in contact with these Tejanos or Mexican Texans, depending what year we're talking about, along this trail. And they are feeling as friends, they are feeling friendship and wanting to assist and help. So when you consider the fact that Texas was not always part of the United States, it was part of Mexico when it first started, you had these folks who were living in what we know today as Texas, but were Mexican citizens. And so they are feeling this sense of camaraderie and friendship and desire to want to assist these people to freedom in the country of Mexico.
So, Ron, how do we situate this history in the current moment right now with Black Lives Matter, with the uprising for racial and social justice that we're seeing across the country? How do we put this in context for what's happening? How do we apply it, if you will, to what's happening today?
Well, it's so important that Black and brown people come closer together and build on this incredibly beautiful history that we have together. Most members of both communities do not know that, many people don't know, for example, that there are even Afro-Mexicans, that Mexico under Spanish rule had a 300-year period of slavery that began and ended before slavery began and ended inside the United States, that the leaders of the independence struggle in Mexico had African roots. Father Morelos, who took up the leadership of the main Mexican army for 5 years before he was captured and executed after the fall of Hidalgo, who initiated the call for Mexican people to rise up and struggle against the Spanish. It was Morelos who led an army that was often referred to as Ejército Moreno, or the Dark Army, because the complexion of so many of the soldiers, the fighters, was black. Because not only did the leaders of the independent struggle wage war against Spain
to secure Mexico's independence, but they also made clear that that war was to also eliminate slavery, which was a big rallying call to many Black people there in Mexico to join the forces of the freedom fighters. The first flag, the flag carried on the battlefield, was a Black flag in Mexico. Many people don't know that history. There were people like Captain Jose Andres Carranza, who was very dark, who was a hate object for the Spanish side, because before many of the battles, he would run to the front of the Mexican lines and curse the Spanish, call them names, talk about their mamas. They would shoot at him. He would dodge the bullets and run to the rear of the Mexican lines, and then the battle would get underway. Many people don't know of him. Many people don't know this history. And when they know it, it causes us to draw closer together.
Ron Wilkins is a retired adjunct professor of Africana Studies at California State University, Dominguez Hills. And Roseanne Bachagarza is a professor at University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And that's our show for today, everyone. Thanks so much for listening, and please continue to stay safe out there. And like we said earlier in the show, we're starting a new series called A Votar, and it's all about Latino voters in this upcoming election. And so we reached out to you, our Latino listeners, to find out what issues are on your minds.
This is Monica calling from Springfield, Virginia. I am a first-generation Colombian American. I'm thinking about the election as getting Trump out of office by any means necessary. Biden isn't my favorite candidate. I was a Bernie supporter, but I realized the importance of this election, and I'm a very big environmentalist. So although Biden's climate plan isn't the Green New Deal, we have a better chance of making some serious progress and necessary changes in regard to the climate with Biden in charge versus Trump.
My name is Paul, and I am a Latino. I live in Wichita Falls, Texas, and my take on this election as it was in 2016 is that, in general, Trump is not sensitive to the needs of minorities. And unlike maybe some Latinos, I don't agree with a lot of his policies. I don't agree with a lot of things that he does to villainize minorities, whether they be Black or Latino. And my take on this election is that it would be preferable for a candidate like Biden to get elected who does understand what minorities deal with, at least better than Trump does.
Keep them coming all this week. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Again, that's 877-865-8253. Llámenos al 877-865-8253. Or you can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and I'll see you tomorrow. Oh.